The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
most prominent
sports
columnists. Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A $1 billion industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today, we'll be talking about, really, one of my favorite people I've ever met covering sports, David W. Checkets, who once ran the Knicks in the glory years of the 90s and Madison Square Garden after that. But before we get started with David, I'd like to tell you about how you can experience a great shave with our great sponsor, Gillette. Gillette has been part of my day for as long as I can remember. A truly great brand. There was never anything else or anything close. My dad used it. I use it. My sons use it. You know what you're getting each time you use it, and that's a great shave. The high-quality craftsmanship of the blade is perfect, and I'm even a big fan of the Fusion Gel Cream. Used it this morning. My friends at Gillette have great news to share that makes it an even better experience. You can now get Gillette Performance delivered right to your door. Subscribe today and get every fourth order free. Check out Gillette online at www.gilletteondemand.com. Welcome back to the Mike Lupica Podcast, and we are joined today on the Gillette Hotline by one of my favorite people that I have ever met covering sports. He is the former president of the Knicks. He's the former president of Madison Square Garden. He is one of those people, Dave Checkets is, and I've told the story for a long time. He showed up. He comes from Bountiful, Utah. I mean, really, come on. And showed up in the big city, and it was like he had been waiting to have this sort of stage and this opportunity his whole life. He had worked for the Jazz before that. I am happy to have him join us today. Hey, David.
Michael, it's been a while since we've had a session like this. It should be fun.
And before we get back to talking about the NBA and the Knicks and all of that, Dave Checkets and his wife, Deb, for people who don't know, are devout Mormons and are about to start a new adventure, only it's not in the NBA right now. Dave, talk about what you and Deb are about to do in the last week of June.
Well, it's interesting because I was working on an NBA project, helping someone buy a club that spoken to me about being involved in the long term and then changed his mind toward the end to buy a minority position for now and a majority position later on, which meant that he couldn't make any changes in the organization. And we had that phone call, which I was disappointed about because we've worked hard on the project. And I thought in my mind that I wanted one more chance to see if I could get over the hump because I've had four teams in the NBA Finals and never won it. Two Jazz years and two Knicks years. But anyway, long story short, the next day I got a call from the office of the president of the LDS Church and a man we have admired for a very long time, even though we've only met him a couple of times. But he called and asked for a video conference with Deb and me and asked us to go and preside over a mission of the church, which is both a proselyting mission with a total of probably 1,000 volunteers in 3 years. And on top of that, he asked us to preside over the relief efforts in Europe for the church. And so we'll be moving to London in the middle of June, and we'll be there for 3 years. And it's actually very refreshing to pull back from all of the business opportunities and business challenges and things that I've been involved with for so long and try to really do good, not only to people that we meet there and volunteers we work with, but the whole relief effort that the LDS Church is involved with, shipping, you know, millions of dollars of supplies and food and water and medical supplies to places where it's really needed. So we're excited about doing that, Mike, and pulling back from everything and selling our real estate in the U.S. and just saying we're going to take 3 years and try to do good.
We're talking to my friend Dave Checkitz on the Mike Lupica podcast. He's joining us today on the Gillette Hotline. And by the way, when Dave says LDS, he's talking about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But Dave, I didn't know until we were talking about this the other day that you guys didn't know where you were going until literally it was like it's like the Olympics deal where they open the envelope and say, okay, the 2020 Olympics are going to be in Tokyo. So Deb thinks you might be on your way to Timbuktu.
Well, there is a film that was taken of us opening our official call, because when we got the phone call, it was, will you do this? Will you serve? Will you pull back from all your professional activities and devote 3 years to helping people? We said yes, and then we had to wait 21 days or so to find out exactly where that was going to be. And so the film of us opening the official call shows my wife with her face buried in her hands. She doesn't even want to look at what it says because she is thinking she's going to be somewhere in Africa or the Philippines or someplace where she's not sure she wants to live for 3 years. And when I read that it was the England-London mission, she jumped up and down on the chair. She so yes, what a blessing to go to a city that we have visited a lot and that we love and where we're excited about living.
And you know, I know that this is kind of a sidebar to the mission and all the important work that you and Deb are going to do there. But to me, this is win-win for me too, because so when you get there, and you don't have to do this right away, just you can start working on like Wimbledon tickets, Premier League football tickets, just you know, for whenever my next trip to London is.
Well, anticipating that I was going to get that call from you, Mike, I've already started because I know it's the first call is, hey, we need Wimbledon tickets.
Sure.
The second call is, or else.
See, but then, yeah. See, here's the thing. Over the 20 years of our friendship, it's more than that. It's 25 years. There have been certain messages left with Mr. Checkitz where I say or else. But Dave, if we play it out, I really don't know what or else means. Okay, it sounds... No, Dave, it sounds good when I say do this or else, but I really have nothing beyond saying or else.
No, I know that, except that with your background, tracing your ancestors, which you know good at doing, Mike. I went all the way back, and the or else became more meaningful as I did that.
All right, I have to tell. Well, there's many stories about my friendship with Dave Checkitz. Here is one of them. Okay, Taylor Lupica and Mike Lupica and Deb and Dave are friends for a long time. But Dave knew that Taylor's all-time favorite Nick was Doc Rivers. Okay, and there came a point where Dave released Doc. Dave, I don't know what happened to him after that. I assume good things happened to Doc. So anyway,
I'm fine.
So Taylor says, did I hear right on the news? And I said, well, yeah, honey, it came down to Greg Anthony. I'm trying to explain it, but she doesn't want to hear that. All she knows is that you've released Doc. Okay. So cut to about 5:30 or 6 o'clock that night. And I see a town car. We live in the same town in Connecticut. I see a town car, pull into our driveway and I hear the doorbell ring and I come downstairs. Mr. Checkitz, not knowing what Taylor's reaction has been, but suspecting what it's been, shows up with flowers for my wife. And all I could think is, you know, this guy's good. This guy is good.
Well, actually, I like Doc just as much as Taylor did. Doc, when he was healthy, you know, I thought our team was one that should win the whole thing. In fact, with him starting in 93, we won 60 games. So he was a big part of what we were doing, and no one was more devastated when he tore his knee up something awful against the Lakers in December of 94.
I was at the game.
Trying to figure out a way to still get into the NBA Finals in a year where Michael Jordan was playing baseball. And of course later we went out and traded a first round pick for Derek Harper, but Doc would never be the same player after that at his age to do as much damage to his knee as he did. But it doesn't mean that we haven't stayed in touch. He won some championships in Boston as a coach and now coaches the Clippers and is the president of basketball ops and one of the more respected, articulate guys there is in all of sports and certainly in the NBA.
We're talking to Dave Checketts on the Gillette Hotline. All right, let's go back to the beginning with the Knicks, Dave. And obviously the game-changing thing and something that I know that you went to the finals twice in the 90s, and we'll talk about this. We didn't know how good we had it in those years, whether you won a title or not, because the Knicks ticket was the best ticket in town. And I've said this to people for years. As good as the Yankees were at the end of the 1990s, you had the sense in New York that the Yankee season didn't really begin until the Knicks had played their last game. But that all started with two things. One, Dave Checketts taken over the basketball operation and convincing Pat Riley to come out of retirement and coach, not only coach the team, but almost reinvent himself as the guy who had been Showtime to a bare knuckle coach in New York. And so let's start there. What was your sales pitch to Pat?
Well, Pat and I had known each other because I had left the Jazz and was working, directing all the international operations for the NBA, reporting to Stern, and Pat was actually doing some work for the NBA, doing clinics in various parts of the world. And so we would, from time to time, have a meal together in New York. And I had no idea that the Knicks job would actually come back to me, but I suspected it would because it had been offered to me several years before while I was still with the Jazz, and the Jazz were having some success, and from time to time the guys at the Garden would reach out and say, when are you coming here? And the Knicks were my team, Mike, from the time I was a boy. I knew every player and of course, the great Red Holzman, who is our mutual dear friend, and I'd never met him, but my dream job was the New York Knicks. And so I would talk with Pat even before the job was offered to me, and I would say to him, we should go do this together, because we'd gained a real respect for each other in the late 80s when the Jazz would play the Lakers, especially in a legendary series in the 88 year where it went to seven games, and my very young Jazz team with Karl Malone and John Stockton and Daryl Griffith and Thurl Bailey gave the Lakers all they could give them. And there wasn't anybody else who came close to them that year. They went on to win the whole thing. But the Jazz really had a great series, and Pat and I had respect for each other. So in these meals, we would plot, you know, what if Dave, they come back to you? What if you get offered the job, and what would it take? And so I had kind of made the pitch there, and the pitch was, look, you look at the talent on this club. We've got to do some things. We don't have enough, but with Patrick and Oakley, at least we've got the foundation to really build upon. And you're the right guy for the job. I was convinced of it because I knew this about Pat. Even though he had the Showtime rep and dressed a certain way, he actually was a kid from Schenectady and was a rough and tumble guy, the most competitive guy I'd ever witnessed. And the more I studied his coaching career and the way he treated players, the more I thought he could help me turn around the whole culture in New York. So over a period of time, I had prepared him for this day. And then when I was announced as the president and general manager on March 1st of 1991, he was my first call after that press conference. And that started a process that led us to May 31st when he agreed to coach the club.
You know, I guess I can tell this story now. It reminds me of another first call after somebody had been put in charge of the Knicks when it was Isaiah Thomas. And I came home that day and there was a message on my answering machine from Mr. Checketts. And he said, it's going to be a disaster, you know. And it kind of turned out to be. Dave, the first, you know, so many great things happened, and you know, it ended badly with Pat, and then you made an unbelievable call to finally replace him once removed after Don Nelson with Jeff Van Gundy. That first year when Pat was there with Xavier McDaniel and Oak and Patrick, you went toe to toe with the Bulls for 7 games.
We did. And if you remember, Mike, we brought in Xavier. We made a trade to get him. And during the regular season, he was like mediocre. Pat hardly played him. He would start him to try to see what he could get out of him, but he hardly played. And then all of a sudden in the playoffs, he elevated his game. We couldn't believe it was the same player. Scottie Pippen wanted nothing to do with him. Scottie Pippen didn't even want to play in that series. Because Xavier was the X-Man was really punishing him in so many ways, and it was a great series against we beat Detroit in the first round and played Chicago in the second round. It went 7 games, and I'll never forget Patrick Ewing spraining his ankle in Game 6, going into the locker room, getting retaped, and coming back in. To help us win that game and force a Game 7. That's when I knew we could accomplish something really special in New York over all those years.
And then in 1994, obviously, an amazingly magical, New Yorkers know, an amazingly magical time because the Rangers are on their way to winning the Stanley Cup, and it looked like we're going to have this incredible double at Madison Square Garden. And the Knicks ended up going 7 games in the finals with the Rockets. The last 2 games are in Houston. Everybody knows that they should have won in Game 6. Stark should have passed the ball to Patrick Ewing. But, Dave, that series was so amazing because in the middle of it, we had the OJ chase when we're watching the Knicks and the Rockets play. I think it was on a Friday night at Madison Square Garden.
It was. I think it's June 16th. It was Game 5, Madison Square Garden. That morning, Mike, I had been down in Lower Manhattan to witness the Rangers going through the Canyon of Heroes and the parade and the affection for that team. And I was down there with Ernie Grunfeld, and we were walking through the crowd to get up to, they had a place for us to witness this at City Hall. And as we walked through the crowd, everybody is reaching out and slapping us on the back and saying, "You guys are next. We're here next week for you." And I actually really believed that would be the case. I believed we would be back there the following week. But Game 5, watching the game with everything at stake, NBA Finals, to watch people getting up and walking out of the building because they, you know, on their mobile device in 1994, they weren't watching the White Bronco. They had to go. Just imagine, they had to go up and stand in the areas, the concession areas,
right,
and watch on television. Well, because NBC had completely interrupted the game to watch the White Bronco drive along. What was it, Highway 5 or the Golden State or something in California?
It was a 405. Yeah, it was a 405.
You couldn't write this. I turned to watch an instant replay while I was up in the box with my guys up there. I turned to watch a replay, and there was the White Bronco. I just couldn't believe the timing of it all. But that happened on the night of Game 5. We still ended up winning, thankfully, and making the series 3-2. But then those 2 games in Houston are some of the most frustrating memories of my whole life. I'm not sure I've gotten over it still.
You know, it's funny. I tell this story all the time, Dave. When I was sitting with Tim McCarver one night when he was still doing Mets games at Shea Stadium, and he's got all his notes and his cigar. It's back in the 80s. And we were talking about something, about some team had a tough loss in sports. And I referenced the 1968 World Series when the Cardinals were supposed to win and ended up getting upset by the Detroit Tigers, and they had been up 3 games to 1, all that stuff. And I innocently said to McCarver, "How long did it take you to get over that?" And he put his cigar in his ashtray, and he looked at me over his reading glasses, and he said, "You never get over it. And what happened on those two nights at the summit in June of 1994, I can hear you on that because, again, if people don't remember, it looked like they're going to win in six, and Starks doesn't throw the ball into Patrick, and he gets his shot partially blocked. And you and Riley had formed, you know, I mean, you guys had been in the trenches together. You had done this thing together. You had come that close. The next year, you lose to the Pacers in an unbelievable ending where Patrick misses a finger roll. Dave, and I know you and Pat are good now, and I don't mean to relitigate that thing, but that was a tough time when Pat left you for the Heat.
Well, that was one of those times where you really find out what you've got, what is down deep, what you're made of. Now, look, we know this about Pat because he's written it. He's a tough guy. He preaches all the time, you know, plant your feet firm, how his dad taught him to do that. Well, guess what? So did my dad, a right, Marine from World War II. And I knew that the fix was in by the way that he handled the resignation, because his agent had warned me that he was unhappy. I'd made him a new offer, a new three-year offer that would have kept him the highest-paid coach in pro basketball. But I could have never planned, Mike, that actually to a coach under contract during the playoffs, Mickey Arison was sending him proposals that included a $40 million package, never heard of in any sport at that point, and that Pat was going to do everything he can, or he could at the time, to get out and take it. And I was indignant about the whole thing, because to me it was not disloyal to me personally. It was disloyal to his players, to the fans. And look, Pat realizes this now and has apologized, and he and I are in good shape. But at the time, Mike, I was going to move heaven and earth to at least get my pound of flesh for what he was doing to us with a year left on his deal to go make the deal and to meet during the playoffs against the Pacers, to have a meeting with another club at that point was, you know, I spent the next 3 months just getting ready for the hearing in front of Commissioner Stern. And, you know, we got first round picks and money, but it, and in a way that was justice, but it was bad form for him. And even though he's been successful in Miami and done a great job down there, I give him a lot of credit in a lot of ways. And I do really admire him in many, many ways. But that was, you know, you can't judge people based on only one act in their life. So I will give him the benefit of the doubt. But that was bad form, really bad.
Talking to Dave Checkitz on the Gillette Hotline. Okay, so the first replacement for Riley is Don Nelson, who has a winning record, and you just, you know, if Patrick's not happy, and even though you have a winning record, and you make Jeff Van Gundy the head coach of the Knicks, because people on the inside knew about Jeff, but I don't think anybody on the outside knew about his basketball ethic, his pedigree with his dad being a coach. And Dave, of all the teams you had, even 94, to me, the best team you had in 97, and you end up losing, to me, I think you end up losing the NBA championship because of an outrageously arcane rule that was enforced after a fight that broke out. This is, I can't believe we're going back over this, but it's, I've been stuck on it for 20 years. Okay. Between Charlie Ward and PJ Brown under the basket in Miami. Okay. And even whatever happened that night, the Knicks are going to go back and win this series in game six, except Patrick Ewing, among others, wandered about 10 feet away from the bench that night and ended up being suspended for game six because they suspended all of your guys alphabetically.
You know, the thing is, Mike, I mean, think about the standard of consistency. It would never happen today.
No.
Look, there had been difficulties in the NBA, but Stern was out And I've said this, I've had this conversation with my mentor and friend, David Stern, who I respect, but he blew it. They blew it. Patrick didn't step 10 feet away. He took a couple of steps onto the floor. It was no big deal. And we had all those players suspended for game six. I don't think we would have won game five, even if that had not happened. No. Although we were on a comeback when that happened. And, but the fight just basically took the air out of us. But to lose Ewing and Allen Houston and all of those guys for that series, I agree with you. That was our best team.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, 100%
that
was.
I mean, we're up 3-1 at that point on the Miami Heat. We just had to come home and win at home, which we would have done. And to have that suspension handed out alphabetically the way that it was, to lose Patrick for our home game, to go in with 8 players, basically, many of whom had not played in the playoffs. And I think we were missing at least 2 starters. I think I've tried to put it out of my memory. It's so frustrating to think about. But that was just bad luck. It was bad administration. It was bad discipline. It was overreaction. And it was Stern proving that he was not a New York homer. And we're left with the memories. That team would have won the championship that year in my mind.
100%. And I remember writing when the suspension, when I understood how stupid this rule was. Okay. And that rule was never written to legislate against a star. That rule was written so that scrubs didn't come off the bench and make a bad situation worse. And I remember, Dave, I wrote this at the time and I've written it ever since. This was, to me, the most profound difference I've ever seen in sports between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. Because whatever the letter of that law was, it wasn't written to prevent one of the great stars of the league from losing his best chance at a championship because he took 2 steps out on the court.
You couldn't be more right about that, Mike. It just was bad form in every way. And I mean, I like all those guys that were in the NBA office. Russ Granick's one of my closest friends. Rod Thorne and I are really good friends. But it was a huge mistake. And I you're right about the scrubs, because if you go back to our legendary battle with the Phoenix Suns, when we were the best team in the East and they were the best team in the West, and we had that fight that broke out between Doc and Kevin and then turned into a team brawl.
Right.
It was Greg Anthony in plain clothes who created the problem for everybody.
Right.
He came
right.
off and started right. throwing a punch at everybody. It was outrageous. But the rule was badly formed, badly implemented, and the crux of the matter is that was Patrick's best chance. They took it away from him.
We're talking with the great Dave Checkitz on the Mike Lubica podcast. More with Dave in a minute, but first this from Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. Now, it wasn't enough in 1999, but there was a form of basketball justice, not only against the Heat, but against Coach Riley, when the number 8 seeded Knicks beat the Heat in the first round on a runner by Allen Houston. And Dave, what is most memorable to me about that series was, and with all due respect to everything Pat Riley has done in pro basketball, Jeff Van Gundy coached the pants off of him in that series.
There's no doubt about it. So much happened that year, Mike, when you think about it.
Oh, really? Yeah, I don't remember. You didn't try to. You didn't talk to Phil Jackson or fire your general manager or anything, did you?
The season didn't even start until January.
Right.
We had Sprewell. We brought Sprewell in. We had 50 games to kind of blow it, and we were two and a half games out of the playoffs with 10 games left to go. with Van Gundy and Ernie swiping at each other and planting stories about each other.
Yeah.
Van Gundy, still not a believer that the Oakley trade made us better by bringing Marcus Camby in. And Ernie believing that he should be playing Camby more than he was. It was just natural because this happens in New York all the time, that coaches and general managers try to discredit each other through the media.
Right.
So I brought them both in. I told them to knock it off. And then, amazingly enough, our ownership, the Cablevision ownership, decided that one of them had to go. And I'm gonna leave out some details of all of that, but I'll just say it that I told them, I pushed back and I said, you guys, look, Phil Jackson and Jerry Krause in Chicago have not said a word to each other in the 90s, and they've won six championships. So don't tell me that one of them has to go. But they were insistent for the most bizarre of reasons. And insisted that it be Ernie. And, of course, you know the story. I fired Ernie with 10 games left to go. I went marching up to purchase to the practice facility. I walked in the locker room, which Coach Van Gundy was very nervous about. What are you going to say? You never come up and talk to the team. And what I said to the team was, look, I've fired Ernie Grunfeld. I'm going to take over as interim general manager. The coach is the coach, but everybody's job is on the line here, and we have enough talent to be at the very least a playoff team. And then I said this, because you know me well enough, Mike, I wanted to pull on some what was really bothering me emotionally, which was, you guys are all wearing a black patch on your uniform to honor the great Red Holzman.
Yep.
The winningest coach in Knick history. 613 wins. If you haven't seen it, look at the rafters of the garden. It's there. The winningest coach of all times. That patch on your uniform is to honor the great Red Holzman. And I know Red well enough, he would be ashamed of the effort that he's seeing from this club. I want a different effort. I want a different energy. I want to be a playoff team. I'm not interested in the lottery. I want to be a playoff team. And, of course, the team went 8-2 and into the playoffs. And to your point about Van Gundy, I think the most impressive thing was actually said by Riley himself when we won Game 5 on the Miami floor. And he congratulated Jeff because he said the coach had a play with 1.8 seconds. He had a play, and the players ran it, and Allen drove the lane, and over Alonzo went up with a finger roll that rolled around for what seemed to be forever, and then fell through the basket, and we had upset the number one seed. And the thing I remember best about that is I'm walking off the floor and toward the locker room, not knowing that Larry Johnson is behind me. And I'm not a small guy. Somehow, Larry Johnson picked me up. My suit was covered with sweat, picked me up and gave me a bear hug. It was such a relief to get by Miami, and then, of course, we swept Atlanta, and then the all-time great four-point play by LJ putting us into the finals. We just didn't have enough in the tank by then to compete with the Spurs, but it was a great year.
Yeah, that's one of those years, Dave, and I try to tell people this. You simply cannot measure sports in terms of championship rings, because I'll tell you something. As proud an achievement as that was the next year, with half of the team limping or wounded, or Patrick on the way out, making it to the Game 6 of the Eastern Conference Finals the next year was great.
Right. Well, I give those guys, I mean, we really put a premium on competitive guys. That's why we drafted Charlie Ward. No one knew whether he'd be an NBA player, but I knew enough about him that for that kid to win the Heisman Trophy and then make himself available for the NBA draft, I wanted to take a chance on him. We all did. And like him and so many others that came through the Knicks in the 90s, We had very high expectations, Mike, always. We always wanted to win. We always wanted to compete for a championship. And that was our mantra. And if you bought into that dream, you could stay there. And we had, as a result, so many legendary times. I just wish for all those great fans in New York that somewhere in that decade we'd found a way to win it. It wasn't to be.
And then, Dave, after that, there's a confluence of events that actually have put the Knicks into the circumstances they are now. James Dolan becomes the big boss of the Garden. You end up leaving. Patrick ends up leaving. At what point did you know the handwriting was on the wall and that you and Jimmy Dolan were not going to be able to coexist?
Well, the interesting thing was it was never about the Knicks with Jimmy. Jimmy asked me to do so many other things, Mike, that became a real distraction for me. The only reason I took the job to run the Garden in the first place was because I didn't want to try to report to some other bonehead who knew nothing about basketball or sports and try to inform him about what we were doing down there. And so because Sumner Redstone and Viacom were pushing me hard to take over the Garden, I thought about it for a long time, and Deb and I really thought about it because I was – so happy. My passion was the New York Knicks, pure and simple. I didn't know anything about hockey. I didn't claim to know anything about hockey. And I didn't want to run all of the assets of the Garden, but I didn't want another boss there. I just didn't want one. I finally ended up taking the job. But Jimmy bought Nobody Beats the Wiz out of bankruptcy. And then he bought a movie theater chain called Clearview Cinemas, and he asked me to take them on, in addition to Radio City, the teams, the network. And I, first of all, they didn't fit with what we were doing. I had no experience in them. I was already working 100 hours a week, and I didn't want to do it. That's what started the relationship down the wrong path. But what really sealed it, frankly, is that I made a deal to keep the Yankees on MSG Network for an additional 25 years. I basically moved to Tampa and spent my time with George Steinbrenner and Lou Katz and Ray Chambers and all of this cast of owners of the Yankees in those days. And I made a deal to keep them on our network for 25 years. And I came back really just feeling so good that I was the one that had finally solved that issue and they were going to stay. And Jimmy thought it was too expensive, and he wouldn't support it, even though his father, Chuck, did. Jimmy would not, and that is where I just said enough already. And I think he was tired, too, of me pushing back always against him because we didn't agree on much. And it was fine. I left in 2001. I put a picture frame in my own mind around the great times we'd had there. I knew the Knicks were going to be a tough rebuild without Patrick Ewing, and I knew that we couldn't get anything for him at that point. We'd probably waited too long. But Jimmy wanted that job. He wanted to run the Garden. He wanted it to be his rules and for me not to be in the way. And so I left in June of 2001 with a lot of great memories of 10 years.
We're talking to Dave Chagas on the Mike Lubega podcast. And at this point, Dave, begins what I call the curse of Patrick Ewing. Okay. Because from the start of the 2001 season until this moment, Dave, you can't process this. And only I seem to care about this. The Knicks have lost more games than anybody in the National Basketball Association. The New York Knicks. We're not talking about the Pelicans or the Kings or the Phoenix Coyotes. Okay. The New York Knicks have lost more games than anybody in the National Basketball Association over the last 17 years. They have won one playoff series since they were in the Eastern Conference Finals in 2000 against the Indiana Pacers. So, Dave, it's a long way around to asking you, what do you think
if you can somehow encapsulate it, what's the big, is it simply the owner, or what does it work here that this is a biblical stretch of failure on 33rd Street?
Well, there's so many things, Mike. It's been frustrating for me to just watch. I care so much and always have cared so deeply about the franchise. It's why I really haven't worked in any other NBA situation. I've advised the guys who bought the Detroit Pistons that wanted my long-term involvement.
Right.
I've advised the guys who are, you know, investing now, the new owners, they will be of the Brooklyn Nets. But I haven't, I've been offered positions at other NBA teams. I just haven't done it. It would be impossible for me to do it anywhere except maybe the Jazz, just because that's my hometown. But the Jazz are in very good hands, and there's no opportunities there. So it's a long way of saying that, you know, I haven't lost the emotional tie to the Knicks. And to watch what they have gone through, to watch what Isaiah Thomas did, to watch what Phil did. You know, I never interviewed Phil for the general manager job because it's a completely different job that he was ill-equipped to take. He was not ready for. He didn't understand the work ethic involved. And the number of boneheaded decisions that have been made in these almost 18 years now. Well, I guess as of March, or in June, it'll be 18 years. The number of boneheaded decisions and the lack of patience, of a plan, of direction, of expectations. I mean, New Yorkers, Knicks fans are now, the idea that they might be a playoff team seems to be enough for everybody. In the 90s, Mike, I would have been thrown out.
Right.
You know, unless we talked about winning a championship, which really was our complete agenda. So the expectations have been lowered dramatically, and they've had some bad luck. I think, look, Porzingis is a real player. When I look at his body, I wonder if he'll ever hold up for an entire NBA season.
Me too, yep.
So his endurance is the whole issue with him, but he's really a very special player, and he's still very young. And so, look, Steve Mills is a guy I hired at the Garden many years ago. I hired him for the business side of the Knicks, but he cares deeply about the team and is a bright guy. Scott Perry was at Detroit when I was advising the new owners about taking over the team, and he impressed me in many ways. And I just hope that these guys will exercise some patience, will develop young players, will draft well, will trade well, will develop well. Because the one thing I know is that this fan base, even with all this bad basketball, and as you say, Mike, losing the most highest number of games over that period of time in the NBA, the fans are still there.
I know.
They still love the Knicks, and they deserve a whole lot better.
Talking to Dave Chagas, I knew I was never going to get to all the things I wanted to talk about. I want to just talk, the day that Patrick Ewing, I've told the story to my friends and they know this, okay? The day that Patrick Ewing got the Georgetown job, I don't remember whether Dave called me first or I called Van Gundy first or Van Gundy called Chagas first, but there was a club of us who loved Patrick Ewing and appreciated Patrick Ewing. And I think the world in the years since he left the Knicks has come to appreciate Patrick Ewing. Taylor was listening to my end of the conversation, and she said, and she could kind of hear what you were saying. I said, we were as excited as teenagers at a concert when we found out that all of the hard work Patrick had done as an assistant coach had finally paid off.
Yes, well, that's the point, Mike. It's about time. And I think you actually made the point to me that one of the 50 greatest players of all times, no one had done more to develop himself and be deserving of a head job. And the fact that the Knicks, with all this bad basketball, the number of coaches they've rumbled through there, how is it?
Yeah.
That they've never thought about giving him a chance or giving him the job or turning the reins over to him in some way. Now, Patrick is not. He shouldn't be a general manager. He shouldn't be the president of basketball operations. But as a coach, I mean, I am pulling for him big time because he cares deeply about people. He cares about the game. He really understands the game. And I think in the lives of the young men that come through Georgetown University, he will be a profound influence, I hope, for many, many years.
Dave, I've told this story on the podcast before. I don't know if I told you. I may have told you this story. But there was a point in a couple of years ago where there was a one-day sensation where everybody thought I was leaving the Daily News, and I wasn't. And I wasn't on social media, and I just told the kids, don't pay any attention to it. This is my turn in the barrel. It'll be fine. Everybody will know they're wrong. Everybody who said I was gone will know tomorrow. Okay, so there's this whirlwind of media, and people are writing. Dave, it's like being at your own wake. People are writing my journalistic obituary, okay?
Right.
After all of this and all the phone calls of the day, about 9 o'clock, the phone rings. And I immediately recognize the voice and the phone number. It's Patrick. He says, did you get fired? And I said, no. And he goes, thank God. And I said, oh, that's really nice. He said, no, because if you had gotten fired, I'll never get a head coaching job. And when I called to wish him a Merry Christmas this year, we were laughing again about, like, yeah, thank God, I'll never get a job. All right, a couple other things. You own the St. Louis Blues, but you were in talks to buy the Rams, and people got the misunderstanding, Dave, that you and Rush Limbaugh were best friends.
That was one of those boneheaded moves. What happened was, Mike, the Blues were really turning around in St. Louis. We bought them in last place. There was no one in the building. And I brought in John Davidson, the voice of the Rangers, Ranger goalie, of the really great guys in all of sports. And I brought him in to run the club, and we were really turning around. And for some reason, voices in St. Louis, both in the media and in the city government, started calling out both me as well as Bill DeWitt, the owner of the Cardinals, about their, quote, Rams problem, because Chip Rosenblum had decided to sell the Rams, and they thought that somebody associated with St. Louis sports should do something about this. So I put a group together very quickly, made up of really outstanding people, and I got a call one day from Rush Limbaugh asking if he could invest, and went down and spent some time with him in Florida at his place, at his house there, and I said, look, we'll let me go back to the NFL because this will be a big issue, and he had guaranteed in every way that he was never going to interfere. He just wanted to stand on the sideline from time to time. And it was no more than that, just a passive investor. And what happened was, when I went back to the NFL, there's a guy at the NFL that I know now I could never trust again. Not Roger, because Roger's always been great with me, but I did tell this one guy close to Roger that this was a consideration. And I think that he just decided to see how it would play with the Players Association and everybody else. He leaked the story. And, of course, there was this gigantic backlash so quickly. It just came from everywhere, and especially the Players Association. And it was one of those things where, people were trashing him so badly and bringing up everything that had gone wrong with him throughout his life. And I called and told him to stand down. I just called and said, look, it's not worth it. You're going to hurt our chances. You should stand down. I'm not going to make you part of the group. And actually, he was pretty gracious about the whole thing. So, but it was a bump in the road that people will never forget. I'll put it that way.
We're talking to Dave Chagas. Got a couple more minutes with him, Dave. And again, a lot of what we've talked about today is meaningful to Knicks fans and to you and to me, because, again, as I said at the start of this, You had to be in New York in the 90s to understand what a great time it was to be at Madison Square Garden. And I've told Pete, Dave this before. Pete Hamill once described the Garden to me as one of the main plazas of New York City. And it became a great plaza. And they, yes, they went to the finals twice and they didn't win it. But so much happened. I mean, Jeff holding on to Morning's leg and the fight with the Spurs on Martin Luther King Day, which you kind of can't make up. I forget, did Marcus get five games? Because I here's what I remember, David. Taylor and I went on a vacation to Jamaica right after that, okay? And it was during that time that he got suspended. And Chekits, his hair is on fire, and the phone rings, and I didn't even think he knew where I was. I'm at the Jamaica Inn. It's like Churchill's old place. It's like you can't even find it. And Taylor was coming back from the beach, and she said, "Tell me that's not Dave." I said, "Well, honey, I think it might be David." I think Mr. Chekits believes that Mr. Camby's punishment might have been slightly unfair. And she motioned for me to put my hand over the receiver. She said, "We are on vacation, and that includes being on vacation from Dave Chekits."
I needed help, Mike. I needed help. I needed a voice much bigger than mine to chime in. So I was trying to persuade you that this was outrageous and unfair. Wasn't that the same situation, the fight where Van Gundy, like somebody swiped Van Gundy. He took a hit to the head.
He got the punch. Yeah, it was a big looping right hand. And Jeff, you know, Jeff was on high alert at all time with that particular group of players. So he's always trying not to make the situation. And he got clipped. Down goes Van Gundy. Yeah, down goes Frazier.
Hit by his own player.
Camby
that was swinging at Danny Ferry, right?
Yeah. All right. Let me ask you one more Knicks question, because, again, you know how much I loved Red Holes. But Dave, of all the things you did at the Garden, your two big moves were with Hall of Fame coaches. One is Riley, but you made Red Holzman part of the family again. Okay. And you made him feel important. And I would be getting on a plane to go to Indianapolis for a playoff game. And there in seat 1A was Chekits, and in 1B was Red Holzman. He became the spiritual center of the Knicks again, and almost like your consigliere.
It's one of the great blessings of my whole life, Mike. I'll never forget it. And you mentioned a kid from Bountiful, Utah. Well, that kid in Bountiful, Utah, watched that guy coach many, many games 3,000 miles away. I just admired the way he carried himself, his intensity, his competitiveness, but at the same time, his tremendous leadership of that group of Knicks in those championship Knicks in the late 60s, early 70s. And so when I met Red, he was even better than I had imagined. And, one of my real cherished memories was in 99 when he passed away after a battle with leukemia. I was invited to come to his funeral at a temple in Queens.
Yep.
And I spoke. I gave the eulogy about my friend and the coach. And part of it, Mike, was taken from things that you had written about him, because you were so close, and you were a very young writer covering the Knicks and covering Red. And so you had a special place for him in your heart as well. But I remember that as a boy, my biggest dream was to play on the floor with Bill Bradley and Dave DeBuscher and Willis Reed and Clyde Frazier and Earl Monroe and Dick Barnett. And I don't know if you remember this, but I was asked to be a pallbearer as well. And the other pallbearers were Willis Reed and Clyde Frazier and Bill Bradley. And to gather around and to lay him to rest in his final resting place was like the greatest honor that I could ever imagine. I'll never forget him. I'll never forget his influence. I still, from time to time, remember things he has said to me and advised me to do, and that have changed my life. He was one of a kind.
Dave, I'm going to leave you with two, just because we need to finish any Red Holtzman conversation with a smile. I'm going to tell you two great Red Holtzman stories. One is, I am hired, to say that I was hired out of obscurity to cover the Knicks at the age of 23 is like insulting to actually obscure people. I was far more obscure than that, okay? And I didn't even know I was being hired to cover the New York Knicks till the second week I was in New York and I saw my schedule, okay? In the second game of the season, they go to New Orleans and they do something, and I wildly second guessed this move Red had made at the end of the game, and it's on the back page of the paper. Okay, the third game is at Madison Square Garden the next night, and I think it was against the Celtics. Bob Ryan was there and witnessed this. We go into Red's little cramped office in a completely different world, and somebody asks Red an innocent question about the game. And before he answers, he turns to me and he says, "Why don't you handle that one, Mike? You've been around this game a long time." And Dave, from that moment on, I loved Red Holtzman beyond all understanding. That year, we're in Seattle one night. And you remember Don Murphy, the ref, okay? And he and Red had a bit of a contentious relationship. And the Knicks weren't very good. I think Red somehow got him to be like 40 and 42 or whoever it was that year. So the Sonics are on a run. The place is going crazy. Red thinks he's getting a bad whistle from Murph. So he calls, you know how he used to you hold up the little rolled up program and, you know, make the little timeouts in. But as the players are coming off, Murph's eyeballing Red and Red is eyeballing Murph. And when the noise subsides, Red says to Murphy, "You like it here, Murph?" And Murphy goes, "What?" And Red said, "You going to open a bar here after you retire?" Boom, he teed. Dave, I sat next to Red that whole season, and it was like getting a PhD in how to coach a basketball game. I literally fell out of my... "You going to open a bar here after you retire, Murph?" It's one of the few teas I ever saw him get. Hey, David Chagas, thank you. Good luck in London. Give all my love to Deb. And again, I don't want you to worry about the tickets now. There's plenty of, you know, plenty of time.
We've got some time.
But Dave,
plenty of advance notice. There'll be a place for you to stay, Mike.
For the last time, we did not know how good we had it in the 90s, because we talk about the glory years at Madison Square Garden. If you were a Knicks fan and you knew that every night was an event for 10 years at that place, you know what I'm talking about. Thank you for doing this again, and good luck to you and Deb in the next adventure of your life in London.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks. We'll talk soon.
Dave Chagas, again, ran the Knicks, ended up running the Garden, ran the St. Louis Blues. He's had about five different incarnations in professional sports. One of my favorite people of all time. This is the kind of conversation we could have gone on for 2 hours today. Please continue to download this thing. The numbers are great. Subscribe to it. Leave comments, and we'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.